Friends, today we hear from Dr. Shandana Banerjee, a medical doctor who works at City of Hope, located in Los Angeles, California. She has expertise in pediatrics, palliative care, end-of-life care, and hospice care. Describing end-of-life care as an art, Dr. Banerjee also developed the End-of-Life Symposium in 2019. An annual event focusing on end-of-life care and education involving physicians, nurses, advanced care practitioners, hospice clinicians, and others who are interested in the subject matter. In this episode, Dr. B shares her life experiences with us, including her love for poetry, and weighs in on the medical aid in dying debate. Thank you, Dr. B, for providing your wisdom to our community.
Well, excellent. We're here with Dr. Banerjee. Did I say that properly?
Banerjee.
Banerjee. Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tell us about yourself. Just introduce yourself to the podcast, to our listeners. We love hearing about personal info. We understand you have a role outside of being a doctor. So anything you want to share about your hobbies, any family or history, university background, start from the beginning. Fill us in.
That's awesome. First of all, thank you. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I think I'm super excited because I've heard amazing things about it and about you. So thank you. So a little bit about myself. I am a hospice and palliative medicine physician by training. I also am a writer, more a poet, and I consider myself an end-of-life advocate. My background is interesting. I moved from India when I was 15. So I came here right as I turned 15. And I pursued undergraduate education in English in Connecticut and went on to do my master's in health administration and public administration in New York at NYU. And then along those lines, as I started working, my father passed away. Suddenly, secondary to complications from surgery, and I found myself completely thrown into clinical medicine, because what I found was that really to make a change in any kind of issues that were serious illness based, having both the administration side and the clinical side really allowed you to make the most impact. And hence, here I am. I love writing poetry. I am married to an amazing man, Sanjeet, and we have a son called Siddhartha Barak, who is 6 and a half, and we have a four-legged son whose name is Adam. So there you go.
Very good. That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing some of that information. What was that transition like for you when you moved to the United States?
It was extremely different, I will say. I'm not so sure I was prepared for anything in particular. I'd always had relatives in the United States, my cousins that had grown up here, some of them were born here. So it's very much, even in India, a blend. The city I grew up in was very influenced by the Western cosmopolitan aspects of life. And so when I came to America, some parts were easy to blend into. I already spoke English. That's the only language I had spoken since childhood that I still consider actually my first language. And in terms of culture, you know, I found that teenagers here had the same needs, the same attitudes, the same reflections, and the same thought processes as a lot of the teenagers elsewhere, including in my own city, given that I came from a very multicultural, diverse city. What was very different is just to see that America as a country, I felt, allowed me to have a voice, which I didn't feel as much as having one in India. I grew up in India, and even though I grew up in a very open, liberal family, I think sometimes voicing my thoughts and my inner concerns and my feelings sometimes were accepted, sometimes were looked down on. And I think as a girl growing up anywhere, the importance of not shutting down your voice is very important for someone's growth and important for womanhood in general. And I think America allowed me that freedom, which I have never given up.
That's amazing. And certainly one of the greatest parts of living here in America is having that freedom of speech and the freedoms that come with being here. Tell me about what was one of the things, if you don't mind answering, like you're kind of coming to America moment when you like really realize like, wow, like this is, I'm really here, or something that really might've stood out, maybe aside from that element of the freedom component, even as simple as like, wow, like there's a lot of fast food joints around here, you know?
I was just going to say, I think having my first strawberry milkshake from McDonald's was something I can never forget. And sometimes I still cheat and go back to having that strawberry milkshake here and there. But
good for you.
It was something that, you know, you grow up hearing about and seeing on TV. And to actually be able to do that and enjoy the taste of it was incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The other thing was being here, just really the seasons were captivating. Where I grew up in India, there aren't four seasons. I mean, there's monsoons, there's summer, there's winter, but you don't see the fall colors that you see here. And I will tell you, my first year, I was blown away by the beauty that this country had.
Thank you for sharing that. I think reveling in those little things are really important in this life. So I can really appreciate you sharing that with us. Thank you. What drew you to the medicine field?
So I have my family, many of them are in medicine. My brother, who's older by about 4 years, he also is in medicine. And, you know, I had a couple of other relatives who are in medicine, both on my mother's side and my father's side. So medicine was always something there at the back of my mind. However, as a kid, I did not want to do clinical medicine. I wanted to make an impact going the route of more social impact or, you know, service to people. And I didn't see myself really going into medicine until, like I said, my father passed away suddenly in 2004. And so prior to that, I was actually working with hospitals and other companies that were indirectly tied to healthcare and vulnerable populations. But then when my father died, it was almost like a calling. I literally decided one day, very shortly after his death, that I needed to go and study medicine to make a bigger impact. And I did exactly that. And I've never looked back. The way I look at it is that, you know, my father died for me to be who I am today. And, you know, that comes with a loss, a huge loss. But I'm also very grateful for him with everything I've been able to do because of me being in medicine.
Yeah, that's a beautiful perspective to hold. And we kind of mentioned earlier when we first talked about having that eternal optimism and maintaining that perspective. And really, that's kind of all we have is how we shape things. And so much is out of our control. So I really admire that that's how you reacted when you had that sudden and shocking loss of your father. And grief is a strange thing. It seems like it has no timetable, right? It's something you kind of grapple with, I think, throughout life, and it's heavier at times than others. So it can be hard, but to see how you've responded is incredible. And I'm sure there's so many people benefiting from that positive attitude. Can you tell us about where you are now and how you're practicing? And tell us a little bit about palliative care. I know that some of our listeners have heard that word before. We haven't had a chance to talk directly to a physician who help support people in that position.
Of course. So I am at City of Hope currently. So I trained in hospice and palliative medicine for my fellowship. After my medical school, I went to residency, and that was in pediatrics, but I wanted to be able to treat adults as well as children for pain and palliative issues. And so I pursued my fellowship at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles, and trained to be a hospice and palliative physician, after which I spent a few months at a hospice learning the art of hospice care, which then brought me to City of Hope as a palliative care attending in the Department of Supportive Care Medicine. And I have been there since I started at City of Hope in 2016, February, and I'm still here. And it's an incredible place to work. It's an incredible place to see patients that you can make a change in the lives of. And it's also an incredible place because there's a lot of teaching that goes on here, not just for physicians like myself, but also for students that are in medical school, for other residents and fellows that are in programs in subspecialty oncology, hematology, and diabetes care. Palliative care as a field is one of those unique fields. I almost think it's sort of the central field in any medicine that deals with complex or serious illness. So to look at the roots of it, the word palliate means to make better, to improve on, right? And so what palliative care as a field does is that it looks at the person that you're treating from a holistic view. You look at the whole person and you take an interdisciplinary approach, an interdisciplinary team approach to treat that patient. The physician and palliative care teams are taught not only to work on complex symptoms such as pain management, you know, nausea, side effects of chemotherapy, you know, symptoms when people are nearing the end of life, symptoms that require extensive management of patients, whether it's in the hospital or in the home setting. But what palliative care also does is that it allows you to bring in other team members like chaplains, social workers, other volunteers, and other services that can work with you and the main teams that the patient is looked after by to all work together to come up with a care plan. So basically, and spirituality is something that is one thing that this field really embraces, because if you look at all the other fields in medicine, chaplaincy or spirituality is never really pulled in automatically. It almost becomes second nature in palliative and hospice medicine. It is an integral part of this particular medicine. What is beautiful about palliative care is that it's available for everybody. People have this misconception that palliative care is only for those who have a terminal disease or those who are at the end of life, but that is actually incorrect. Palliative disease can be for anyone who has any symptoms or any needs for a palliative specialist. Palliative care specialists also then work with patients, you know, towards their journey. And if that journey is towards the end of life, palliative specialists will work with them and then transition them into hospice, which is a continuation of palliative care towards at the end of life. So it's one of those fields that is a beautiful field.
Yes, it covers so much. And from my own personal experience, this was something I hadn't really heard much of prior to being sick. And when I began care at UCSD, my oncologist immediately referred me to the palliative team at UCSD, and they have just been tremendous, offering so many different resources in those various areas that you mentioned: social, emotional health, spiritual, physical. And what a difference they make. It's really been,
it's
massive to have.
Yeah, it's also that field that actually keeps the patient and the families at the center and really focuses on quality of life, on what the patients want, really what their needs are. And then it actually helps patients find that happy medium in medicine and in their treatments.
Absolutely. It certainly is a balance. Having cancer or a disease or any of these health problems, they can be a full-time job in itself. So that support is really, really impressive. You mentioned a little bit about hospice. Can you tell us, and you did kind of point out the difference between palliative and hospice. And I think from what I've learned a little bit through this podcast experience is some people do get those a little bit confused or maybe mix them up a little bit. Do you mind just kind of clarifying a little bit between the differences and then telling us as well some of your hospice experiences? You mentioned having some of that experience earlier.
Yeah, so the difference primarily between palliative and hospice care is really the eligibility. So whenever a patient with any kind of illness is terminal, or let's say within 6 months or less to live, they become eligible for the service called hospice. Hospice is a service that's provided and provided to most Americans. It's covered by Medicare, right? And it is something that can be available to patients at home or in a facility or any location they choose. What hospice is a service of interdisciplinary team members, much like the palliative team members. So you have a physician, you have a social worker, you have a nurse, you have a chaplain, and you can have other people based on your needs, like volunteers that come to your location, whether it's the house or the facility you choose to have hospice at. And they really manage your symptoms and they manage the family and the patient's emotional needs, social needs. Many a times, you know, families will be stressed and will need help filling out paperwork and to get medications. They may not have transportation, or they may need to be with their loved ones. So hospice can provide for that. Hospice, really, the goal is to focus on comfort care, to make sure that you have as much quality of life from the day you enter hospice until the day you die. And that's really what they focus on. So anyone who has decided to give up curative treatments, or they don't qualify for curative treatments automatically, and if they're in the last 6 months of their life based on the prognosis that has been given to them by their physicians, they are eligible for hospice care. And so that's the main difference. With palliative care is something that can occur before the 6 months of life. But keep in mind, the core of the symptom management and the other things that palliative care provides is the same thing that then continues in hospice care. So it's just basically the time frame that we're talking about. 6 months or less to live and beyond qualifies you for hospice care. Anything beyond that is palliative care. But some people do get scared and do still have the stigma around hospice and do not want to enter hospice. We know that data has shown that people that enter hospice early actually live longer because of the quality of care they get and the symptom management and the focus on quality of life. But for those that do not really enter hospice care, they can still continue with palliative care at the end, towards the end of their life. So that's basically the difference. I recommend both to really my patients. I always encourage them to consider hospice if they're in that 6 months or less time frame, just because having worked at hospices, you know, it's not like the stigma is very different. People think of hospice as a place to die, which is very different. It's a service. It's not a place to die. And I've seen that over the last 15, 20 years, hospice is very different than what it was. It truly focuses on quality of life. And it really is as much as the relationship you build with your team and the quality that you create for yourself. That's all what hospice is about.
These are wonderful answers. Thank you so much. And I have just tons of questions from listening and hearing this awesome information. One of the trends I think that I'm seeing as we talk with different professionals and people based on this topic of death with dignity or medical aid in dying, which I think we'll get to coming up here, is that it does seem like there's this trend in which we in America might have a difficult time discussing this topic of death and dying. And I wondered if you agree with that. And I also wonder how do you operate day to day in a field which can have such an impact, right? I mean, I'm sure you're losing patients and seeing people that you've helped care for pass away regularly. And how does that impact your perspective or how you operate as a person?
I think the biggest gift that I got with my father's dying is the opening of my eyes to really understanding how important it is for everyone, especially as adults, to discuss death and dying and your wishes around them. It all comes down to the fact that I don't think any one of us wants to die a poor death. No one wants to suffer. That's not what a normal person would want. And so what often happens is that when you have a society that is reluctant to talk about wishes, about advanced care planning, about really what you want for your treatments when you are suffering and when you are in an emergency situation, often leads to rash decisions made by both patients and family members on behalf of those patients. And it really creates obstacles to providing probably a peaceful death that the patient may have ultimately wanted if given a choice. I think as a society, we need to start normalizing the conversation around death and dying. We need to start being mature adults, not just for ourselves, but our colleagues and other family members and relatives and our friends. I think we need for everyone to understand that we're all mortal, we're all going to die. And so if you had the ability to let your wishes known and to help make choices that would prevent a death that had suffering involved, I think we should all as adults do it. It's really important to have advanced care planning. It's important to have these conversations to your physicians, especially if you are battling with a serious illness. I think it's important to engage in that conversation with your physicians, with your friends and families early, very early on in the disease process.
Thank you for sharing that. Absolutely. I personally, throughout my experience with cancer, and more specifically since starting this podcast and having these discussions with these various professionals, I feel that my relationship and perspective with death and dying has changed for the better. I feel much more comfortable with where I'm at, where I'm heading with my disease, with my family, and how they perceive things. And that's one of the things that I tried to make sure I did, was talk individually with each of my family members about why something like medical aid in dying is important to me. And just the fact that, yes, I do have this terminal disease. It will not be cured. At some point, I will die from this cancer. And it's important that we understand that. It sucks, right? It's terrible, but realism is what's important here. And as you mentioned, as a species, we all will experience death at some point. So it can be a little discouraging to think that we shield ourselves from these discussions so much. And I think that it can be very beneficial to have them. It's not like we need to sit around discussing it all day, being morbid, but just what you said, advanced care, knowing what your wishes are, sharing your feelings and just where you want to end up is so important. One other piece too, as I mentioned, these discussions have helped me in a positive way with my relationship with death. And I wonder how your role as a doctor in palliative and supporting people in hospice as well, how do you view your relationship? Is this something that impacts you every day? Is it kind of like a roller coaster in terms of emotions? Can you tell us a little bit about how you handle such a difficult job?
Thank you. You know, I feel honored to be in the position that I am in. Obviously, I got drawn more to the field of palliative and hospice medicine due to my own experiences with my father's death, right? I saw him suffer, even though I was physically not present. The stories I heard for his final days weren't stories that show a peaceful death. He got delirious. He ultimately had a cardiac arrest and he passed away. And this was all secondary to infection from surgery. Just so knowing that and knowing how long it took me to really grieve and and work towards coming to terms with what happened, you know, propelled me into this field of palliative medicine. And what I saw, even when I was in my residency, which was not in palliative, which was in pediatrics, you know, I saw that even in medical school and residency, physicians aren't really taught end of life care, or death isn't given as much importance. You know, when I look at it now, reflecting back, there is an art to end of life medicine as well. And that's something that until recently was not taught in medical schools, what was not taught in residency. I remember, you know, when we were on rounds in our residency program, everything from diagnoses to treatment plans were discussed. But then when you had a patient that was either terminal or was towards the end of life, not much was discussed about it, and we just moved on to the next patient. That really made me think about how difficult is it, and how difficult do we make it when we don't address these issues with patients and with their families, the anticipatory grief that gets left untouched, and then the amount of grieving that needs to happen when the patients or the loved ones die, is just something that we are creating a mass disservice to our humanity if we don't talk about it or address it. So that naturally pushed me to palliative medicine. And what has been the beauty of this field is that I know I am in this field to make sure that the suffering that I saw my father go through, or the suffering that I have seen others go through, is something that I try to prevent in patients that I care for. And then I also try to educate my other colleagues that are physicians and other clinicians that the approach to end of life and end of life care should be done appropriately as a medicine, as an art, so that we start normalizing that in medicine as well.
Absolutely. I love how you describe that as end of life care is more of an art. I just think that's a good perspective to have. It's obvious that you were drawn to this very early and recognized this, I guess, disconnect early on. How is it in the medical field with other colleagues who aren't as involved in palliative? For example, I'm thinking about how you mentioned during rounds, you guys would work together about coming up with plans, but then it seemed like when you'd get to that point, like, well, we don't really have much else to offer. What do we do? Let's just kind of move on. Is that still somewhat of a taboo thing? Do you think it's becoming more accepted within the medical community and they're doing better at referring people to things like palliative and hospice?
Absolutely. I do think that looking back at medicine, even 15 years ago, we've come such a long way. And that's thanks to the advancement of the field of hospice and palliative medicine. I think the field in general has grown. There are a lot of studies that have shown that early involvement of hospice and early involvement of even just palliative care is really for the better of the patient. It's improved their quality of life. And in some instances, it's actually even improved the length of time that they've lived compared to the prognoses that they were given. You know, it's one of those fields that is getting more accepted in mainstream medicine, especially in fields where you are dealing with a lot of complex and serious illness, such as cancer care, right? I think even the idea that now most hospitals are looking to involve palliative care early on in ICUs when patients get admitted, to have these discussions around advanced care planning and goals of care, and what the patient would want or what the families want, is something that is much more accepted in today's medicine world than it was probably 15 years ago. I've seen that change personally, and I've embraced it. And part of the reason I think that's happening is because just of the research and the data that is coming out of this particular field, showing its help in other fields.
That's wonderful. Beautifully said. And yes, just excellent. Excellent to hear that it's becoming more mainstream and accessible for people. That kind of leads me as well to the overall topic of death with dignity, as well as here in California, we call it the End of Life Option Act, and it's often referred to as medical aid in dying in other areas in our country. And I wanted to ask first how you became aware of such a law or a practice, if you will. I guess we could call it a practice. And what your thoughts were initially, if they've changed at all, and just how you perceive the End of Life Option Act or the idea of medical aid in dying.
Of course. So, you know, practicing in California, we always, first of all, very much on the forefront of looking at all the advances that happen. And with Oregon really at the helm of really creating this there, with Brittany Maynard's case and other cases such as hers, you know, it didn't take someone like me who already is very invested in making sure that end of life for patients is a peaceful one to accept it, right? So I was already a physician, a practicing physician, when the law went into effect in California. So I was wonderfully embraced, accepting of this particular law. The reason being, when you work in a cancer center and when you work at a hospice, you see how people suffer if they don't get the appropriate care towards the end of life. One of the things I found with medical aid in dying is that really it kept the patient at the center, right? It allows for patients to have the autonomy and the choice in how they're going to die. For people that don't really know much about medical aid in dying, I just want to dispel the myth that it is not medical assisted death. It is not suicide. It's not a physician assisted suicide. It's not euthanasia. What medical aid in dying does, it allows a patient who is already dying, that has 6 months or less to live, to go to a physician and get a prescription for medications to ingest on their own when they feel that the time is right for them. Now, keep in mind, many of these patients are going to die within the 6 months, or if not sooner. It is one of those acts that allows patients to make this choice and to at least have the ability to take the medicine or not take the medicine, but at least have the option to have it so that they have peace of mind for the remaining days of their lives, not having to worry about a painful death, a death full of suffering, a death when they're totally debilitated and cannot do anything but lie in bed, dependent on others. The eligibility criteria is very, very clear. You have to be within 6 months or less of dying. You have to be an adult, 18 or older. You have to have the ability to make decisions, so mental capacity. And you have to be able to self-ingest the medication, whether it's orally or through giving it to yourself via a G-tube. But you have to be able to have that ability to do it. And so it definitely makes sure that the patient is capable of making these decisions and making these choices for themselves. This is the first time that any particular law has allowed for people in the country to do that. You know, what it also has allowed is allowed for people to open the conversation around end of life and different options available at end of life to them with their physicians, right? So when you look at other end of life options, you have something called comfort care, where towards the end of life, you're put on either medications or morphine drip or an opioid drip, which is increased based on the symptoms and the needs, right? There's something called VSED, which is where you stop eating and drinking, right? And that's something the patient can also choose to do. There's something called palliative sedation, where we use medications that are very similar to the ones used in medical aid in dying. However, these medications are given by a physician in the IV form in a hospital, where, you know, the end purpose is to make sure that the patient is sedated. And we know that they're dying, but at least they're sedated and they will die peacefully. But all these palliative sedation and comfort care are physician-led, right? VSED, which is the voluntary stopping of eating and drinking, is something that the patient can control. End of Life Option Act is something that the patient can actually do by themselves. It's just getting that script from the physicians who have determined you to be eligible. And then you have the option of doing it on your own. So it really allows the patient to take that end of life in their own hands. And you know, I often get asked by people, are you worried that people are going to abuse this? Are you worried that people are going to misuse it? I have never found that in the last, since 2016, since I've practiced this and helped patients have a peaceful death. I've never found one patient who has abused this. In fact, I've had some patients who chose to take the prescription, but never filled it or never ingested. And that's part of the beauty of this act. Just because you have the option, not necessarily you have to use it. And patients actually know that. Patients know from beforehand when that they're going to die, that their disease is going to be one that just progresses, and the progression of it will mean pain that cannot be relieved, pain suffering that cannot be relieved, debilitation that cannot be reversed. And so in these cases, we've seen patients have made the appropriate choices and used it appropriately.
Wonderful. Excellent description, including some of the pieces about the pain and suffering. I feel that certain patients draw a line in which there's so much that they can endure. And at least for myself, there's certainly a line. I've experienced chronic pain. It's not any good, as many people can imagine. And unfortunately, with the disease like cancer, it will get worse. And it by a lot, right? It's bad. I mean, it's a horrible way to go. So having that option is very important to someone like myself. Now, with that, I think what's so important, I try to stress to people, is that it is just an option. It's not something that is mandated when following through with, as you said, visiting with doctors and obtaining that prescription. However, it seems like in our country, when we have some of these debates and discussions about body autonomy and such, it's always very heavily contested, even though if I were to use this medication, really, it wouldn't have much impact on others around me, right? It's something, a personal choice I would be making. I wanted to ask, your experience coming over to the States, do you think that was almost pushing you in that direction? You mentioned recognizing the freedoms that we have in this country. Do you think that kind of helped shape you towards being more compassionate and understanding towards something like medical aid in dying?
I would say, you know, I do feel that. I think this country is forward in many ways when it comes to, you know, things like death and dying. I'll tell you, I am extremely proud of my heritage of being Indian. And India, I think, is one of the most spiritual countries that I have seen. I've visited many countries, and I do feel like the spiritual aura in India is just something different. However, it's still a country where opioids are limited when they're necessary. People at the end of life still don't have palliative care options. Hospice is something that's still not very well understood. I have known several people towards the end of life in India, including some of my family members, where, you know, we knew that they were dying, but the physicians were afraid to give them the pain medication or the morphine to keep them comfortable. And so I do think that as beautifully spiritual and open that India was, I feel America, or the United States in particular, is far ahead in some of these concepts on looking at death and dying and coming up with options that are available to patients that will help ease their end of life journey. And that's something absolutely that medical aid in dying has brought to the forefront. Even though controversial, at least it's brought the conversations around death and dying, the importance of advanced care planning, the importance of really the other options available, the importance of having goals of care conversations really to the forefront. So if anything, even those I feel that are not accepting of medical aid in dying should be thankful for it, because it's brought all these other issues that are necessary for us to discuss to the front of medicine.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that and being so honest and open about some of those perspectives. When you talk with patients about this, can you tell us a little bit about how that subject is approached? For example, do patients generally approach you with the idea of it, or is this something that you have to share? And with that as well, are there ethical and moral kind of boundaries? How far can you really go with this? Obviously, you don't want to be in a position where you feel or someone feels you're pushing this on them, I'm sure. So it's a very delicate balance. Can you tell us about what that process is like?
Yeah, I'll tell you what the process has been for me, and then I'll tell you what I feel should happen in medicine. You know, most of the patients that have used medical aid in dying secondary to a prescription, either I've written or I've consulted on, have all approached us. I've never really been in a position before where I have had to discuss medical aid in dying with a patient. They know what medical aid in dying is when they approach me. They have done their history, their research. They know exactly who to ask and the questions to ask. We often assume a lot of naivety on the patient's part when they come to us, but patients are very aware of what's happening to them, and they welcome the discussion and the dialogue with their physicians. And so in my experience, you know, I have been able to counsel patients on really what medical aid in dying is when they've come to me with that question, specifically being, you know, I've heard about this medication. I've heard about EOLOA. Can you tell me if I'm eligible for it? Or do you think that's something I could look into? And clearly in educating them and making sure that they're eligible, we've talked about various other end-of-life issues and other options that are available. And the patients that have come to me with this, they have a very accepting idea of medical aid in dying. They actually respect it. They believe that it should be available for every American. They like the idea that it allows patient autonomy. So I've never really had to convince a patient to use the End of Life Option Act if they've been eligible for it and that they've come to me with this. What I do feel is that as a medical field, we should really look into normalizing medical aid in dying, just as we have the other options, right? Like palliative sedation, voluntary stopping of eating and dying, eating and drinking, really comfort care, hospice care. These are normalized. And medical aid in dying is just yet another end of life option that should be normalized so that, you know, patients can actually avail it. What I do find though, is that there's still that equity issue and the disparities at the end of life, which is also very apparent in medical aid in dying. We often find that, you know, those populations that already are experiencing disparities in healthcare and in health equity, whether it's by race or language or ethnicity or socioeconomic status, are the same patients that don't have information about medical aid in dying and are not informed or educated enough on medical aid in dying. And that's where I find myself struggling, is how do we make sure that we also we protect these patients, and then we let them know that there is this option that is available to them if they're eligible for it. And that becomes the fine line in terms of how do you do it single-handedly as a physician, or how should we as a country have this discussion with our population?
Absolutely. You put in a lot of thought into this whole topic, and it's appreciated. Can you tell us a little bit about the barriers to accessing this, and also maybe about whether it's colleagues or patients who may not agree with the topic? And even if you've ever been had an experience in which a patient does not at all agree with it, or maybe just shares their opinion, just tell us a little bit about some of that other viewpoint and from your experience as well.
So I think let's talk about culture in general, right? So as a culture, not everyone has the same ideas and same beliefs. We all know that. And sometimes, you know, there are colleagues that do not want to be prescribers or consultants for the End of Life Option Act because of religious beliefs or personal moral beliefs. And it's completely well and respected. The only issue I have with that is that I do respect my colleagues' decisions not to participate, but I also want to make sure that they transition care of that patient to someone else who does participate in End of Life Option Act, and that they don't become barriers to the patient really getting or making use of the End of Life Option Act because of their own personal moral or religious beliefs. So that's the one thing that I will say. The community in medicine and various fields in medicine still have to learn a lot. They have to learn to let go of their personal biases and prejudices and think what's best for their patients. So that's one thing. The other thing is when patients are often negative about any end of life option, whether it's the End of Life Option Act or another end of life option that is available to them, it's often because of the misinformation or the miscommunication that they have. Many times, as physicians, especially in palliative care, we are one field that is privileged to spend a lot of time with our patients and their families to really understand the patient, to see what their needs and wants are, what they see as barriers to their care, what they see as end of life, what they see as the treatment plans that they would like for themselves. Not every field in medicine gets to do that. Not every field in medicine gets to spend an hour, sometimes more, with the family to really learn about the family and the family dynamics and the emotions that are in that family. And so what the beauty is that we can sit and we can work with the patients and the families and really come to a consensus and come to a treatment plan, whether it is choosing the End of Life Option Act or whether it is continuing with treatments, based on the best interests of the patient and based on where the patient needs for us to meet them. It's all about making sure that they are at the center of this journey and not the physician.
Beautiful. Love it. Love that answer. What do you envision for medical aid in dying in the future? How do you see it unfolding in this country?
We're lucky. We have multiple organizations and full disclosure, I am on the board of Compassion and Choices. It's an organization that's really near and dear to my heart because not only do they work on medical aid in dying, but also all other end of life care issues to make sure that end of life is equitable to everyone in America. Through the work that they've done and other organizations, we already have 10 plus one state, like 10 states plus DC, right, that have this option available to them. My dream would be that every American has the option for this once they're eligible for it. Given that, not everyone is eligible for this particular option. You have to meet your eligibility criteria. But then how are we as human beings, if we know that an option is a peaceful option and it's not really impacting other people, how are we as human beings doing the right thing if we prevent other people from having this peaceful death and having this autonomy? I think we need to question ourselves as human beings if we are, as individuals or as a community or as a society, posing a barrier to someone else's peace at the end of their life.
Yes, again, beautifully said, Doc. This has been wonderful. Every time we have a guest on, it seems like it gets better and better. Each guest just brings something different and new and better than the before, and is making this production and this experience very encouraging, very powerful. It's helping me in my own journey, and I'm hoping as well, helping others as well. You are just doing a beautiful job explaining your role and how this is important and helpful to so many people. It's so encouraging to me and empowering. So thank you. Your compassion and your heart, it's such a lovely thing to share with our audience. I do want to be respectful of your time. I know you've got lots of things going on, lots of people to help. I'd like to send it over to Hazban, and he usually comes up with some good questions as he listens throughout the discussion. So Hazban, if you've got anything to ask, feel free to jump in here.
Hi, Dr. Banerjee. I agree with Andrew that you hit some of the points that we've heard before really well. It's funny, you can hear the same thing three times And that third time you hear it, it just clicks. And the way you spoke about some of these topics, I think will be really useful to people learning about it. As you were speaking, I was thinking about this. Is there like any, you talked about working in palliative care and that how it exposes you to, a certain, just a certain part of medicine that other doctors don't experience. So I was wondering, is there data that shows, or even your personal opinion, that shows the differences in opinion between doctors who work closely with terminal patients and those that don't?
I'm pretty sure there's data on there because like in today's world, there's data on everything, I think. Mm-hmm. I think if you think of it, it's been done, is kind of the assumption. But I'll tell you my personal opinion, and having met many palliativists and many people from other fields in medicine, just because of the nature that palliative medicine really is the connecting medicine that connects all these different specialties together, I do feel that palliative care and palliative physicians are more attuned and more sensitive to understanding the needs of the patients and their families, and are focused on the holistic approach to patient care than many of the other fields in medicine are. And I think that that's what makes this field special. I think the good thing about palliative care is that as medicine is now accepting it more and more, you can see that there are medical students that are taking more rotations in palliative care, learning about palliative care and the symptom management early on opposed to later. There are residents in multiple specialties that are actually learning to approach end of life in their fields. That's really something that's come about because of really all the research and all the data that has been shown that palliative care has been beneficial to everyone. And I do think also as a field, it's beneficial to people in medicine. I think our other colleagues in medicine are realizing that palliativists have a very different approach to medicine. And my dream is that someday all medical fields in their training will actually have a requirement that palliative care should be taught within that field. So much like I think normalizing death and dying, much like normalizing end of life care, I think palliative care should someday, I hope, become the part and parcel of any medical field training that you're doing.
That makes sense. You guys do just touch every part of medicine. I've personally actually spoken to a couple of physicians that had no idea about medical aid and dying. They were from like the Midwest. And when I even asked them about it, they were just so unaware that I was amazed. Do you think that palliative care doctors, because of their experience, are more likely to support something like medical aid in dying?
I would assume, I would hope so. I will tell you, I don't know the full data on that, but I will.
Yes.
I actually know colleagues in my own field who do not want to be prescribers or consultants to medical aid in dying. And that's usually, I feel, comes from not a medicine perspective, but more from a religious and a personal moral perspective. But I'll do tell you that there are more people than not that you'll find in palliative care who are open to the idea of medical aid in dying, at least based on my opinions and my assumptions and opinions and what I've seen people in my field do. I think it's important that, when you look at societies like American Association of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, or other societies like the Oncology Society, they take a statement that they take some approach towards end of life in their fields that really becomes accepting of something like medical aid in dying. I think that's the one way you can educate people on not just medical aid in dying, but just end of life care in general. I think overall, unless you're in hospice and palliative care or really dealing with critical care and complex diseases, most physicians don't really think of end-of-life care as part of their daily practice. And so I think it all comes to first trying to normalize that aspect of it, trying to teach our physicians and our clinicians that death is a part of living. And teaching them the right way to approach it is going to be a huge victory for medicine in general. And I think once that happens, acceptance of something like medical aid in dying will be much easier. So it's really hard for people to accept medical aid in dying, let alone know about it sometimes, like you said, without first even understanding that end-of-life care itself needs to be taught first. Right?
Got it. That's all I had. I also just wanted to give you a little credit for when you spoke about the peace of mind comment. Something that you made really clear that I didn't think about before. We're all scared of dying. Usually the fear is about a painful death, you know, but for someone that's completely healthy, that fear is a little bit more unrealistic at the moment. But for somebody who's going through pain in this moment, who has, like, you know, cancer or something serious, they have to actually think about that really strongly because it feels like it's right around the corner. And I realized that that is actually a lot of suffering and a lot of stress. And the way you said it really just hit the point well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope people really start paying more attention to issues like this, because I think at the end of the day, they're more like human issues. I think
people
are here. We all know, how is it that we can't see our pets suffer, but we're okay seeing another human being suffer? That makes no sense to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well said. No, that point for sure. Dr. V, what else, as we're kind of winding down, is there anything you'd like to share with the audience or listeners, something that we didn't hit on or just something that's close to you that you wanted to share about the topic?
I think one thing I do think is important, looking at how COVID has affected this country and the entire world really, is that not just physicians, but everyone listening needs to find that one space in their hearts that they can turn to for their burnout and their grief. Because I do think that that comes hand in hand with anything that relates to life and death, to sickness, and to complex diseases. You are going to have anticipatory grief. You're going to have grief. You're going to have loss. You're going to have regret. You're going to have burnout. And so what I tell my physician friends and my colleagues is that find that one outlet for you and hold on to that. For me, I write poetry. I've always written poetry. And I find myself going back to that, going back to using words and thoughts and emotions to put all those emotions in words and writing so that I have an avenue to really grieve. I have an avenue to express myself so that I can wake up the next day helping, wanting to help and take care of other people. I don't think physicians make the time to take care of themselves. And I think that needs to happen. I think that's the only way you can sustain day to day so that you care the best you can for your patients. So I think that's my message to physicians. To your patients, my message is don't be afraid to ask your physicians the hard conversations and the hard questions. It is your right to do so. It is your right to ask them, what does the next year or the next few years or the next few months look like for me? That, I feel, is a hard question that many patients don't ask, but that's exactly the question that need to be asked so that you as patients can really plan your journey and you can do what you have to do. You can focus on your quality of life and really be with the loved ones in the best way that you can. So ask those questions and don't be afraid.
Wow. Again, what a way to cap it. Beautiful. Dr. Banerjee, just thank you so much. Your compassion, empathy, your heart, and your service to people is so impressive, inspiring, and motivating. And I look to definitely use this recording and some of these thoughts to kind of lean on and reflect on and help navigate in a positive way forward. So thank you so much for your time and talking with us and sharing your experiences and your heart with us. I mean, it's not easy to have these discussions, and it's people like you taking that risk and having the courage to do so that normalizes these things and makes it easier for people like myself and our listeners. So we really, really admire that. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, husband. I am honored to be on this show. So I look forward to, hearing more from you, and I look forward to collaborating more.
Sounds good, Doc. Wonderful talking with you. We'll be in touch. Take care, okay?
Take care, both of you. Yeah.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.